There are a few preliminaries that are necessary in order to set our motivation correctly. On your side, not so much my side. My side, I think I need to just take a deep breath. So the first thing that is necessary is change our motivation and to be very careful and be very mindful of not bringing in anything from the outside inside here. Hence, we leave our shoes at the door. But the other thing is that the most important thing is that we bring our perceptions a little bit further towards the front of the room. And that's the danger. So, when teaching in the Tibetan tradition, the lamas traditionally would tell you when listening to the teacher, not to look at the person, but to listen to the words. When listening to the words, listening to the meaning of the words. When listening to the meaning, listen not to the interpretive meaning, but to the definitive meaning. So in my case, when you look at me, don't look at the hair. Listen to the words, and that will tell you whether I can be of benefit or not, whether what I'm saying is true or not, whether I'm a charlatan or not, whether I'm just basically sitting on a cushion and trying to be something that I'm not. Secondly, on your side, more importantly, there are three principles of the pot, which is any teaching that you listen to, whether it be the Buddha, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, or something as simplistic as this class here, we should not be like a cooking pot that is without a base. So whatever goes inside the pot does not fall out. So we have to retain what we're listening to. Secondly, we should not be like a cooking pot with a lid on it, closed-minded, simply because you're white, you've got long hair, receding hairline, you're not Tibetan Lama, why do I need to listen to you? Thirdly, which is the most subtlest point of all, which is not to be like a cooking pot that hasn't been scoured or cleaned. It still has grease from previous things that have been cooked in it. So whatever's put inside is contaminated by previous material. So you can put the best food possible inside there. It's still going to taste like garlic. So what that relates to is you don't come to a class with biased, preconceived notions. You come with an open mind, willing to accept what's going on and clear an acceptance. So in other words, you must have the proper motivation. Even if you just remember one word of what I say, that is enough to be of benefit to you to go and see His Holiness the Dalai Lama, for example. Maybe there's a point that I can clarify, I can answer a question, something to that effect, and that's enough to inspire you to do something, go somewhere, something will happen. The same principle is involved whether, as I said, whether Shakyamuni Buddha is sitting here, His Holiness the Dalai Lama or my root guru is sitting here, because if it's a true Dharma, then it's like a diamond. If it's the Holiness of the Dalai Lama, then we talk about a diamond as big as the Ritz. That's a literary allusion there for anybody who's into F. Scott Fitzgerald. Or if it's a slither of a diamond, it's still a diamond, whether it's this big or whether it's 30 stories high. A diamond is a diamond. So even in simplistic discussion as this, we still have to have the proper motivation. If we can't do that here, then what chance when His Holiness gives a teaching? So from my experience, when I talk to people that go to see His Holiness Dalai Lama or one of the other high lamas, and I ask them, what did you learn? What what did you retain from His Holiness's teaching? And they said, well, you know, he's so wonderful. He laughs a lot, so jovial. Looks great. I love the colors and whatever. They just got carried away with the charismatic personality of them, of His Holiness. Nothing was retained. Why? Improper motivation. They don't know how to behave in front of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. They're just there for the spectacle. But if we're genuinely sincere and have an understanding, that little diamond, if we have that little understanding, then we need to know that every book, every person we speak to who is a Dharma practitioner, lay or ordained, high lama, no lama, none, whatever, they can provide us with some kind of information from their own experience. And that's what we're after. That's what we're after. How did you do it? What kind of mala do you use? Why do you use that? Where did you go? Where did you go on retreat? What happened? Provide me with this information. That's what it means to be a spiritual practitioner. I'm after the freedom of the soul. I'm not here to entrap myself as much as possible. And I'm trying to find somebody who has freed themselves or is directly on the path to freeing themselves. Who you are, what you look like, what you smell like is irrelevant. I want to know how you do it. How did you do it, if you've done it? And if you haven't done it, why not? I want to know what you're doing about it every day. That's what it means to be a spiritual practitioner, irrespective of religion. Irrespective of religion. Because for those of you who may know a little bit, when we're talking about, I think the Prophet Muhammad said, the greatest jihad is the jihad that we have against ourselves. You don't hear anybody saying that on the news. The greatest jihad is the jihad we have on this self-cherishing I. I mean, what's the difference between that and what the Buddha said? But of course, that aspect of Islam, if I can just put that as a footnote there, that aspect of Islam is the esoteric aspect of Islam. So you have to hunt up for that. You have to find somebody who thinks like that. You have to find somebody who's searching for that. Those people are very, very, very rare. Likewise in Buddhism. Everybody's in love with Tantrayana, the Vajrayana path. Very, very few people understand what the Vajrayana path is. Very, very few people practice it. And even fewer people realize the Vajrayana path. But the most important thing for everybody, irrespective of religion, irrespective of who you are, where you are, is to realize what you've got at the moment. That's the most important thing. Coming here, setting up the center, what an extraordinary feat. You know, what an amazing ability to have just a space and time. How Einsteinian is that? You know, to actually have the luxury to get away from children, to get away from work, to get into a car, and to come in here and just to listen to somebody you've never met before in your whole life, that you know of, talk about something that you have a cursory introduction to Buddhism. The thing is, if we believe in karma, we really genuinely understand the law of cause and effect, you realize that, well, we're just basically continuing what we've done before. Because the preciousness of this life, the preciousness of the Buddha's teaching, the preciousness of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and the Arhats, the Sangha, the Arya Sangha per se, to come in contact with that is, there is no number that you can comprehend that can give you the statistics as to how rare it is to come in contact with that opportunity. It is beyond calculation. Why? How many sentient beings are there on this planet? Most of them live in the ocean. How many insects are there? How many microbes? How much life is there in the universe? How much life is there in the other universes that exist? Multiverse. The Buddhas talk about multiverses, even in the Hindu scriptures. Now recently, in the West, the astrophysicists are finally catching up with the Buddha's teachings in that respect. So, to have that opportunity, the time, the space, the effort, the luxury. Nobody's forcing you to come here. Anybody being paid to come here? If you are, I'll give you your money back later. You know, that to be to that, that implies there is a karmic connection. That's what you have to think about. That's what you really have to. I'll see you in 6 months. Go and meditate. I'll see you in 6 months. So we have to see clearly what we have. And what we have is a precious human rebirth. And they say, well, all life is precious. From a Buddhist point of view, yes, yes. But a precious human rebirth, from a Buddhist point of view, technically, is somebody who has a karmic connection with the Buddha's teachings. Human life, from a medical point of view, is precious. But from a spiritual point of view, it is even more precious because you have a direct connection with the Buddhist teachings, which is the key to get you out of samsara. Your next door neighbors don't have a connection with the Buddha. Your own relatives who you love and cherish don't have the same connection with the Buddha as you do. Likewise with people at work, people that you know, living or dead. Their connection with the Buddha Dharma is not as deep or doesn't even exist relative to your understanding of Buddhism. So therefore, we have to clearly look in the mirror and see, not from a Zen point of view, but from a conventional point of view, we have to see who we are and what is it, where do we stand? As you may have read in some books, start from where you are right now. You can't start from where I stand. It's not possible. That's my karma. Each one of you have to look within and you have to ascertain clearly, psychologically, where do you stand. So before we get onto a spiritual path, we have to understand ourselves psychologically. That's why a lot of intellectuals, especially when the Buddha Dhamma came into the West, were attracted to Buddhism because they loved the psychological aspect of it. Buddhism is all psychology. Right, yeah. I don't think so. So Buddhism, we can take as a therapy, we can take it as a philosophy, or we can take it as a religion. That's why people get confused. It's a fractal. It depends upon one's karma, what you see. As we, those of you who know anything about quantum physics, again, science is catching up with the Buddha's teachings. In quantum physics, your mere presence of looking at something affects that object. That's karma. We call that karma. So simply being in this room, we change the environment of this room, all of us. Because we have, or as I was saying earlier, our motivation has to be pure, otherwise you won't be able to hear what I'm trying to say to you. You will become that greasy vessel that I was speaking about, that pot that's greasy. Whatever's put inside there is contaminated automatically by that grease. You didn't clean that. That uncleanliness is improper motivation. So that's why it's possible to look at me and just say, well, you're not Tibetan, you're not a monk, you're not qualified. Well, that's your karma. Again, there's no reason for me to be upset about that because that's something that you are experiencing, not me. So some people may say, gee, Robert, what a great guy you are. And someone will say, I don't want to go near you. So who's right? Who's wrong? They're both right. They're both right. Because they're coming from their own karmic experience. The most important thing here, me, as the man in the middle in this example, I don't care. Love me or hate me, whatever. Thank you. I walk the middle path. Majjhimika. And not to be, oh yeah, you like me? Okay, I'll go with you. You don't like me? Well, you know, well, let's have a war over here. It's got nothing to do with me. It's your decision. You decide. And that kind of behavior basically sums up our human relationships. Everything, everyone you know falls into that category. Nobody that you know of walks the middle path as prescribed by the Buddha. Nobody that you know. Which means you have a direct perception of emptiness, true reality. Nobody that you know falls in that category. So, the most important thing that we have is this precious human rebirth. And the cause, what is the cause for this precious human rebirth? The cause for this precious human rebirth is previous prayers, dedication, and morality that we have practiced in previous lifetimes. Monks, nuns, maybe, possibly, why not? Hopefully. But definitely, this body, this physical form, is the result of our previous karmic actions. There is no doubt about that whatsoever. So, you basically owe it to yourself to continue what you have started a long, long, long time ago. The example that I always used to give to people is, you're on a bus and your ticket only takes to a certain destination. You've got to get off. This is where you've got off. Now you've got to buy another ticket to get on another bus. But we don't want to do that. We like the view. I'm staying at the cafeteria. I just met a nice blonde girl. You know, we're going to talk for a little while here, you know. So you get distracted. Time goes by. And before you know it, the other bus has left. You didn't buy the ticket to catch the bus to take you further down the road. So that means not to waste this life that you have, this precious life that you have. You have this small connection with the Buddha Dharma. There are many, many books on the Buddha Dharma. Hands up everybody who understands everything that's in one of those books. Hands up anybody who has the direct realization of every single topic in that book. So, there's a lot of work to be done. So we have a connection to come in contact with those books and many, many other books. Do you have the karma to read those books? Do you have the karma to understand what's in those books? Do you have the karma to come in contact with a teacher that is a realized teacher? At best, the Buddha. At second best, a bodhisattva. That can actually help you and guide you through that maze and show you what you need to adopt and what you need to abandon. So, if we haven't done that, then we're only partway there in terms of fulfilling this life, making this life worthwhile. More purification is necessary, more dedication, more understanding, more prayers, more renunciation from this world, and not to be preoccupied with mundane aspects of this world. We've got everything we need here in Australia. You're not persecuted for coming here. This isn't like some secret society where we're hiding in an attic because we're all part of a religious cult that the government has banned. We can buy and purchase books. You can buy malas. Whatever you want, whatever you need for your spiritual practice is available. You have jobs. If you don't have jobs, you can borrow money. You can use that money to go on pilgrimage, to enhance your practice, to see where the Buddha lived, walked, talked. You can sponsor other people to do that if you like. There are many, many things you can do. You don't need to be a monk or a nun. It's not a requisite. the most important thing is to realize the human potential that you have. Because it's not your clothes that achieve enlightenment, it's your mind that achieves enlightenment. So it's not necessary to think, oh, I wish I was a monk, I wish I was a nun, I wish I could devote my life in a cave somewhere, you know, and that's it. Well, be careful what you wish for. Because in the Tibetan tradition, there is a story of, I don't know if you've heard of Ajitsu Milarepa, a famous yogi. I won't go into details right now. He was a famous yogi who lived out in the caves. He was a mass murderer. He killed 38 people, renounced life, which, you know, killing 38 people is a good enough reason to renounce suffering. Good inspiration. And anyway, he was giving teachings one day, and this man came to his teachings, and he got very, very inspired. Fantastic. I'm going to do the same thing. Divorced his wife, abandoned his kids, quit his job, sold the business, took the food, went off into the mountains. 3 months later, he comes crawling down, looking like a skeleton. He said, "That damn Milarepa made a beggar out of me." He's got nothing now. Because he just went on shallow faith. He just got inspired. He went to a Dalai Lama teaching, so to speak. Wow, I'm going to do this. He just threw everything away, not understanding his psychological profile, not understanding his weaknesses and his strengths. And he thought it's just so easy to give everything away. And now he abandoned everything. He lost it. And because of that, his suffering increased millions of times over. And because of that, he didn't have time to practice Dharma because he was too busy looking for food. He was too much suffering for him. He didn't have the karma to be a yogi up in the mountains. It's a dream. It's a fantasy for 99.9% of us. So we have to look in the mirror and clearly see, where do we stand? What are our weaknesses? What are our capabilities? What is our psychological profile? What upsets me? Etc., etc., etc. So it has to be psychological before it becomes spiritual. That's what people forget. They rush off into a religion that really only just superficially satisfies them. So His Holiness the Dalai Lama never encourages anyone to become a Buddhist, especially when you were born in a different religion, brought up. And His Holiness gives an example of a Tibetan woman who, during the early years of the exile from Tibet, converted to Christianity. And she said to His Holiness, she said, "Your Holiness, you know, this time, in this life, I'm a Christian. Next lifetime, I'm going to be a Buddhist." Totally confused. It's like a game. So here we see clearly how somebody doesn't understand what's going on, doesn't understand the motivation, doesn't understand the purpose of faith and religion. And basically, they are using their life as some kind of shell game. Now you see me, now you don't. Now it's this, now it's that. That's an improper way to live a spiritual life. So we have all this luxury, we have the time, and even the poorest of the poor people, at least in this country, in Australia, are still much, much better off than people in India, certain aspects of Latin America, certain aspects of China, Asia per se. We're talking about harrowing poverty, where people are just scraping to find food, something to eat. Yeah. Here, we throw it away. We are so lucky here, in order to sweat, we need to go to a gymnasium. We don't work the field, planting rice and corn and working 15 hours a day in the sun. We work in air conditioning. We don't sweat unless we want to sweat. That's how luxurious we are. And then people say, "No, no, no. I want $100 million in the bank, I want everything gold, my toilet needs to be made of gold, the bathtub of gold, whatever. You want to live in this, in a God realm. But the thing is, by comparison to most of the world, you are living in a God realm. You are living in a God realm. You don't have to work very hard. You've got everything at your fingertips. You can take out a loan. You really have more money than you really need. Even if you're in debt, you still have more money than most people. So we need to clearly look in that mirror and see, well, hang on. I don't need to be afraid of living on the streets. I don't need to be afraid of, I need $100 million in the bank and then I can go on retreat. And then I can devote myself purely on Dharma. You're wasting your life if you're thinking that way. The time to practice is now. If you're here tonight, you'll practice. As soon as you leave here, you have to ask yourself, what is it that you're taking out of this room? In other words, you're a pot that has a bottom, that does not have a lid on it, and that is clean. So what you're receiving tonight, you're taking with you, and you're bringing it out there into the world. There is nothing that you can bring in here that will be of value, in this example, to me. Nothing. It's only what I'm giving to you, or anybody else that is up here giving the teaching. That is the most important thing. What is it that you are taking away from here? That's why it's important to always, whatever teaching you go to, you leave your preconceptions out there. Because it's said in the scriptures, if you perceive the teacher as a Buddha, then you receive the blessings of a Buddha. If you perceive the teacher as a bodhisattva, then you receive the blessings of a bodhisattva. If you perceive the teacher as a normal person, you get nothing, because a normal person does not have the ability to help you to achieve enlightenment. So, quantum physics. My mere presence at looking at something changes that thing. So by looking at the teacher in an enlightened way, then I receive the blessings. That's one of the core aspects of Tibetan Buddhism, and it is an aspect that is not spoken about generally in public because it's open to abuse. Because if you get an improper teacher, then they're going to be telling you, well, I'm a Buddha, give me your money. I'm a Buddha, you have to buy me a car. You need to buy me 15 Rolls Royces. I need one every day. Blah, 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 blah. Very, very easy to abuse. And also, very, very easy for the so-called teacher to, for the ego. If they themselves are an improper teacher, the ego clicks in. And you as the student, you get sucked into somebody who's an improper teacher, you go down with them. Very, very important to be finding the proper person that we are willing to put ourselves in their hands. That takes years of observation, years of study, contemplation, seeing that person under different situations. Do they represent your psychological profile? For example, if you're a very heavy set person, trucker or a bikie or one of these archetypal people that are supposedly very aggressive, your teacher is not going to be somebody who's meek, mild, very soft spoken, whatever. Your teacher is going to be 10 foot tall, he can bend iron bars with his teeth, or she maybe. Why? Because if you're an aggressive person, you need somebody that's 10 times more aggressive than you to pacify you. Because as an aggressive person, you're not going to listen to a pipsqueak. You know, you're going to, oh, somebody 10 foot tall. Yes, sir. So that goes back down again to psychological profile. If you don't understand you yourself, if you're addicted to aggression, your teacher needs to be somebody who's very, very authoritative, very scary. And I've met quite a few lamas that fall into that category. Without even talking to them, they're scary. So, precious human rebirth. We can spend years on that one subject. It's very, very important. So, all those people who are you know, saying they want to do Vajrayana, etc., etc., or the tantric stuff, my advice is to forget it. Put it aside, put it in the cupboard, because the door to Vajrayana is forever closed unless you have a bodhicitta. That's the bottom line. Really. You will never be able to open that door unless you have genuine, uncontrived bodhicitta. Yeah? And the way you become a bodhisattva is what we're discussing now, the foundations of Buddhism, which is precious human rebirth. Seeing what we have, where we live. Yeah? The environment that we live in. We have access to books. We have access to the sangha. We have access to lay practitioners. We can ask questions, get rid of doubts. There is no such thing as a stupid question in Buddhism. If you don't know, you don't know. You know, it's as simple as that. We live in a time where it's possible to access the Buddha's teachings. We haven't had the fortune to be living at the time when the Buddha was around and to have the presence of mind to practice. But now is that time. And you have the karma to live in a fortunate place. You also have the mental faculties to understand. You're not deaf, you're not mute, you're not mentally impaired. You can retain information, you can ask questions, you can read, you can analyze things. You can ascertain what's right, what's wrong. You can ascertain what to adopt and what to abandon. These are all attributes of precious human rebirth. And so, the contemplation for that would be to be looking carefully at why you're interested in the Dharma. What do you know about the Dharma? For most people, they don't know why. I don't know why. I mean, some of you born into Buddhist families, but does that make you a Buddhist? What makes somebody a Buddhist? Prostrations to the Buddha? Anybody can do that. Little children prostrate to the Buddha, but they don't know what they're doing because they only see you doing that. So does that make them Buddhist? No. Buddha's t-shirt? No. What makes you a Buddhist is taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. Believing in the law of cause and effect. Believing in previous and future lives. They are the three prerequisites to becoming a Buddhist. Specifically the first one. The other two Hindus we share in common with the Hindu religion. So a lot of people don't even know that. So when you ask them, are you a Buddhist? The reality is, no, I'm not really a Buddhist. All this time I thought I was Buddhist, but I'm not. Because what does it mean to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha? How much faith do we have? It's just a statue. Guys, it's just a statue. So, we have to look carefully. When we're giving flowers, food, etc., etc., what exactly are we doing? Well, it's through the blessings of the Buddha that we have a physical representation that represents certain qualities. The most important quality is that it represents, through the Buddha's 32 major and 80 minor marks, indicates that enlightenment is possible. Through studying how the Buddha did it and coming to the conclusion that enlightenment is possible, then you develop a veneration and a faith that is unshakable. And then you say, when you offer some food or flowers to a statue, then you're actually accumulating merit, purifying negativities, and actually changing your mind by offering food, water, money to a statue. On the outside, it just looked like, what are you doing? But on the inside, there's a whole universe that's just changed. That's what it means, in simple terms, what it means to take refuge. Because we've done that many times before, we find ourselves doing that through the law of cause and effect. Here we are, we're doing it again. But the thing is, now it's a much shallower process. It's not as deep, our faith is not as deep as it was in previous lifetimes. Why? Simply because of living in samsara. Why? Simply because we've lived many, many lifetimes before, previously, and this lifetime, excuse me. Many things have happened. And so that's why, as my Lama says, when you find, in the context of finding a Dharma teacher, a proper teacher to study with, when you find somebody of that caliber, he or she, ordained or lay, you hang on to that person, just like a cat hangs on to your leg. You hang on to that person, whether they beat you, scream at you, whatever, you never ever let that person go. Because that person, as your Lama, is the only one that you have a strong karmic connection with to get out of samsara. Now, a lot of people, because we live in a competitive world, in a corporate world, you know, we always want the best. It's only natural. You want the best car, you want the best looking wife, best job, best chocolates. Everything has to be the best. That's great. And we can get that. Again, wow, Australia. Wow, England. Wow. If we're living in any of these so-called first world countries, have the karma to do that. Amazing. I rejoice in your good fortune and merit. You deserve it. It's the result of your previous actions. If we have that ability, again, we need now to wake up to the fact that it's not going to last. Because that bus ticket only takes you to this point in time. You're doing everything you can not to buy a new bus ticket to take the other bus. In other words, we're getting distracted by our work, our family, and all this wonderful life. Our merit is being eroded. We're spending our merit more than we're accumulating merit. If any of you want to talk in accounting terms. Yeah? So you're actually spending more than you're earning. Because the only way we can perform any virtuous action, virtue in Buddhist terms is defined as any action in body, speech and mind that is a cause for enlightenment. So, helping an old lady across the road is not a cause for enlightenment. But if you have Mahayana motivation and you say, ah, by helping this woman across the road, it is just, now I'm being a little bit Zen here, it is just like me taking this old woman across the sea of suffering to the other side. If you have the presence of mind to say that, that now becomes a virtuous action. Now you have accrued the merit. That will last, if you dedicate it to that person and to all sentient beings, will last as long as samsara endures. It becomes a cause for enlightenment. But this is a little bit, I'm jumping the gun here. This is Bodhisattva's way, where all actions can be converted into actions for enlightenment. So the focus here and the emphasis here that I would like to say without using a bullhorn is to wake up, to really consciously, seriously look carefully and say, I've got everything. I've done a lot in my life. It's okay. It's fine. Now's the time to really do something. If you're lonely, no problem. No problem. Spend some time on yourself, work on yourself. When you become happy, boom, cause and effect. Happy people come to you. No use being depressed and running after people. Love me, somebody, give me a hug. Nobody wants to hug a depressive person. Nobody wants to know a depressive person. So it's our responsibility. It has always been our responsibility. My happiness is my responsibility. Ultimately, all religion, all faith is teaching us to be independent, not to be dependent. All religion is teaching us to be independent, not to be dependent. Anybody that really wants to wants to play master and servant with you. I'm your lama, you do what I say. Anybody like that, you have to look at very, very, very carefully. And really, seriously, see what you might be getting yourself into there. Is somebody playing power games with you? Do they want to take advantage of you economically, sexually? They want something from you. They want you as a servant to feed their ego. If you find yourself in that kind of situation, even in a relationship, personal, work-related relationship, then I strongly consider changing partners, changing work, changing spiritual teachers, so-called spiritual teachers, because you're only going to waste this precious human rebirth. So, with this life that I possess, there is nothing that I can't do. I have the potential to achieve enlightenment. I have access to teachings. I have access to His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, should I choose to do that. If I want to, I can go on pilgrimage. I can spend the rest of my life on retreat. If I have the karma, I can become a monk. But not necessary. It's not necessary. Once we look very carefully at that situation and see where we are, then we have to see something that a lot of people sort of regard, when we begin to talk about it, a lot of people regard Buddhism as a pessimistic philosophy or religion when we start talking about death and impermanence. So we see what we have, and then we see that we can lose what we have. Because the causes for life are few, the causes for death are many, many, many causes for death. So, in order for me to live, how can I prolong my life? Well, push-ups. I can eat cookies. I can exercise more. Watch Scarlett Johansson films. Cheer me up a little bit. What about death? I can die laughing, I can die in my sleep, I can die eating a sandwich, I can die falling downstairs, I can die bumping my head on the wall, somebody can kill me in a car accident, on and on and on and on. My own family members could kill me because they want money. I could die accidentally, somebody could hit you on the head. You can die from sneezing, you can die in your sleep. Many, many causes. So the causes for death are many, the causes for life are few. So automatically, when we think about that, wait a minute, hang on. I've got a precious human rebirth. But the cause to be alive, it's a miracle just to wake up in the morning. Wait a minute, hang on a second. Forget about the $100 million. I need to have this body. I'm buying time. In essence, we're buying time. That's all we're doing, because we need time to practice. We need time to develop, to grow. That's the most important thing you have. Yeah? It's not how much you got in the bank, what position you hold in society, whether you're a king, whether you're cleaning toilets for a living. It makes no difference. It makes no difference. There's a story of a lama, Tibetan lama, in old Tibet, medieval Tibet, 10th, 12th century. He was in India. There's this lama who, his root guru, his principal teacher, who was a very high yogi, his daytime job was, he was a swine herder. He cared for pigs. And his primary student was this monk, you know, very prim and proper and all this kind of stuff. And he was kind of embarrassed that his teacher was this filthy swine herder, and he kind of never mentioned him, never spoke about him or anything like that. One day when he was giving some teachings out in the field under a tree. His teacher walked by with the pigs, and the lama ignored his root guru, and he pretended not to see him. Because of that, he went blind. And later on, he went to his guru for help, and his guru restored his eyesight because of his pride, as, you know, thinking that, you know, I'm better than my lama. I'm, you know, more students. I'm, you know, I don't have to do that filthy job. I am somehow better than you. You know? I don't need you anymore. But in reality, he needs his teacher. You know? So we need to know as well from our own side. At the moment, we may not have a teacher. But we need to look carefully at this precious human rebirth. And not to squander it, not to, because of our pride, because of our egotism, not to be diverted to other things or other priorities and our responsibilities. You may own a business, you may have family, you may have all of the above. But at the end of the day, when the time comes, there's a very good chance that you will die in a state of regret. Now, a lot of people, if you're feeling uncomfortable by that, good. If it somehow scares you in a certain way, good. That implies that you're thinking. It's a little bit like your boss saying to you, listen, I don't like what you've been doing recently. I'm going to give you 3 months. 3 months? That's it. You're 3 months. If you don't shape up, that's it. Okay, that's still kind of him. You've given me 3 months. That's nice. You didn't sack me straight away. So it's the same thing here. There's a good chance you may die in a state of regret. No. Don't talk about death. Let's talk about something else. That's unrealistic. A realistic person plans their life properly, understands their life from beginning to end. From that, it's possible to have a very happy, very fruitful, very productive life. Not only for yourself, but for other people. Why? Because you're not running away from your karmic obligations, which is, you're definitely going to die. Currently, His Holiness the Dalai Lama is the 14th Dalai Lama. What happened to the other 13 Dalai Lamas? So, the Buddha himself had to pass away. So if holy beings have to pass away, what does it say about us? All the soldiers that fought in the First World War, none of them are alive anymore. The last one died maybe 10 years ago or something like that. Out of the 6 to 10 million soldiers on both sides of the war, one man was left standing. Unbelievable. Aged 110 or something, I don't know. Unbelievable. Today, how many of us will be alive in 100 years' time? Including those that are born today, how many will be still alive in 100 years' time? The causes of death are many, the causes of life are few. So, you have a precious human rebirth. You have a time limit. What are you waiting for? So, we can clearly see that everything's dependent upon us now. Again, the motivation is up to us. So if you're feeling uncomfortable about this, well, it's meant to be that way. You know, in Thailand, we see monks and nuns contemplating in front of a skull or a corpse or something like that. It's meant to frighten you, especially if it's your relative, somebody that you love. Not recommended for everyone. Because psychologically, if you do it without supervision of your teacher, you're probably biting off more than you can chew, and you can actually psychologically hurt yourself, to put it in a nutshell. So it needs to be done under supervision. But I'm saying it in this case because I don't know if I'm going to see you again. so to speak. So you have to open your mind. You have to challenge yourself to a point. To a point. We don't need corpses. We don't need skeletons to remind us of ourselves. Turn on the TV. That's enough to frighten me. I don't need to look, smell the blood. It's enough to frighten me. And it's a story of the Buddha. In the Buddha's lifetime, if you remember the story of the woman who came to the Buddha with her dead son, the body of her child, and she said, "You're the Buddha. You can do anything. Bring back my son. Bring him back alive." And he said, "Okay. Go down to the village and bring a mustard seed from every household that has not had somebody that has died in their family." And of course she came back empty-handed. And then she understood, this is what samsara is all about, impermanence. Those who are born must die. What goes up must come down. What comes together must come apart. It's the physics, it's the dynamics, it's the way the universe is constructed. It has to happen. It has to happen, sooner or later. It may happen in a trillion years, but it will happen. The mountains will be eroded. Eventually the earth, the solar system, the sun will come to an end. And eventually the universe itself will come to an end as it had started. And it will start again. So if there's a cause, there's an effect. Beginning and end. Yeah? So that in itself, go off and meditate in the hills. I'll see you in 20 or 30 years. Tell me, if I see a rainbow, I know you made it. So all these things, obviously, I'm rushing through, and we've only got limited time here, and I'm only up to the second subject. Usually, when I give these discussions on a weekly basis, teachings, it takes 12 to 18 months to go through the whole process. That's just me talking. That's not the contemplations. That's not the meditation subjects. That's not answering the questions. That's not getting rid of people's doubts. That's not guiding people. That's a lifetime commitment. So, one of the unique aspects of Tibetan Buddhism, one of the unique aspects, is that all the four schools of Tibetan Buddhism, in chronological order, they are the Nyingma, the Sakyapa, the Kagyupa, and the Gelugpa. They are the main schools of Tibetan Buddhism. What is the difference between them? They are all chronologically appeared as Buddhism came from, as prophesied by the Buddha, came to Tibet in the 6th, 7th century. They follow different lineages, different masters, where started those different schools. The Gelugpa tradition, which I'm a part of, was the most recent main school, which is started by Jetsun Kapa in the 14th, 15th century. That is the school that His Holiness the Dalai Lama is part of. It is probably the main school of Tibetan Buddhism that everybody sees. It's the most popular. But they all follow what is known as the Lam Rim, stages on the path to enlightenment. That, the Lam Rim itself, was expounded. Lam Rim Chenmo, the great stages of the path, was written by Jetsun Kapa, who is the founder of the Gelugpa tradition, who himself is a commentary on a teacher who is a Tibetan Lama, who was invited to come from India to teach Buddhism. And the teacher wrote a brief, perhaps a one or two page summary, point form, of all the Buddha's teachings summarized in point form. That shows you how enlightened the teacher was. That he can actually, how his knowledge was amazing, that he could actually summarize all the Buddha's teachings, every aspect of it, in point form. From that, that was sent to India for the scholars to ascertain whether it was correct or not. All the scholars in, all the pundits in India said this is correct, brought back, and it was taught in Tibet. And that is the core foundation of the sutra path of all the Buddhist teachings in Tibet. It's the Lam Rim, stages of the path to enlightenment. All the four schools have that. There are small variations in terms of terminologies, etc., etc., but that's the core aspect of it. And that's really what I'm discussing here tonight. But I'm only up to the second subject. So the other just unique aspect, whilst I'm on that, about Tibetan Buddhism, is that Tibetan Buddhism is the only branch of Buddhism that has the complete Buddhist teachings. The Hinayana, the Mahayana, and the Vajrayana path only exist in the Tibetan tradition. They don't exist in any other tradition. And it's complete, unbroken form. The lineage is complete and unbroken since the Buddha's time. It's the only lineage, branch of Buddhism, is Tibetan Buddhism that has that. No other lineage contains that. Vajrayana only exists in certain aspects of it, in China and in Japan, maybe one other place that I'm not sure of, but they're the other two, which are only the lower tantric practices. But the highest yoga tantric practices, for example, the Kala Chakra and others of that caliber, they are only from the Buddhist tradition. No other tradition has that. So they are complete. And that's what makes Tibetan Buddhism very unique and more than precious. Much more than precious. People don't understand when His Holiness the Dalai Lama is giving teachings. They just think it's if they don't understand what His Holiness is saying, you're missing out. You're spending this precious human rebirth. Oh, I love the jokes he says. That His Holiness, what a great guy. So, dude, you're missing the point. He's a Buddha. He's trying to show you something. Yeah. It doesn't work like that. So, briefly, with karma, because now this is it. You've spent that karma. That karma is gone that's brought you here. It's finished. It's finished. That ticket, that metaphorical ticket, it's gone. Now you need to create the new karmic connection with Buddhism in this lifetime if you want to continue on down the path. In other words, you need really to absorb as much Buddhist teachings, true Buddhist teachings, this boils now down to what I was alluding to before, finding a true, genuine Buddhist teacher to guide you and help you. Not to be diverted into anybody or everybody that says, yeah, I can help you here, read this book, whatever, and you just get confused. And then you're with some lama or somebody who calls themselves whatever, sits on a throne that's 20 foot high, whatever it is. Wow, you must be qualified because nobody can sit that high without qualifications. You're so close to heaven. Wow. It doesn't mean anything. Even if you could fly through the walls, read people's minds, it doesn't mean anything. Why? Because you're not helping me. If you could levitate off the floor right now, so what? A fly can do that. Big deal. Has anybody seen recently, what's that street magician, Dynamo? He's on the streets. He does these amazing tricks. He says they are tricks. You know, he's a magician. You know, he gets a bottle. Can I use your mobile phone? He gets the bottle and he goes, 1, 2, 3. And the phone is inside the bottle. How does he do it? Now, for argument's sake, let's say it's real. Let's say he really can do that. The thing is, it would look exactly the same way. Whether it's a trick or whether it's real magic, like you have supernatural abilities, it will look exactly the same way. But here's the thing. Even if you, as a yogi or a Buddha, can do that, what's the big deal? So what? You're only entertaining. You're only an entertainer. You're no better than a street magician. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't. These supernatural abilities, powers, have no benefit whatsoever unless you're using them to help somebody. Unless you have bodhicitta. If you can read my mind and say, gee, Robert, he's going to jump off a cliff, I better go and help him out. Now we're cooking. Now you're talking. But if you're finding out what, you would read my mind and find out what my PIN code is to my bank account and whatever and all this kind of stuff, you're no better than everybody else. Pride, anger, jealousy, power, influence. Now you have supernatural abilities. As we all know in those Chinese kung fu films or whatever, the magic emperor, he wants to rule the world. Well, it's the same thing here in the spiritual world. I just want millions of students. I want everybody to do what I say, blah, 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 blah. So that's why you have to be very, very careful who you choose to follow in a spiritual sense. In politics, no problem. You want to vote for Donald Trump? Go ahead. It's okay. You can undo your mistake. But in a spiritual way, once you choose the wrong teacher, you cannot undo it. Not for eons. Because that karma will send you to a lower state of existence. There will be eons and eons before you can begin to burn off that negative karma. If you may remember in the life story of the Buddha, there is a story of where Motgalayan, who was very known for his psychic abilities, supernatural abilities. And for whatever reason, he was in hell on this particular day, assisting somebody, helping somebody. And somebody approached him in hell and said, you know, I am Swami such and such and such. I am head of this order. Can you please, when you go back, can you please tell my disciples not to make any more offerings and prayers for me? Because every time they do, a shower of molten lead comes on my head. And he said, yeah, no problem. I'll do that for you. So Motgalayan goes back and he tells the disciple, he's basically telling these disciples, you're practicing a false religion. Your teacher is born in hell and he's telling you not to do that because he's suffering. And number two, don't do it because you too will be reborn in hell following him because you're following his teachings. So it's the same thing here. The scriptures clearly say, the Buddhist scriptures clearly say, if you pick the wrong teacher, not only will he go to hell, but you will follow them as well. So, death and impermanence. We don't have much time. We don't have... we have the opportunity to practice the Dharma, but we don't have much time to practice the Dharma. What needs to be done now? So clearly now we have to see what we need to adopt, what we need to abandon. So we need to adopt the Dharma in a much more constructive and a much more heartfelt way. We need to spend more time on that because that is the only way we can purify our negative actions. It is the only way we can accrue the virtue that is necessary to free ourselves from samsara. And on a mundane level, it is the only way we can find happiness in this life as well, conventionally speaking. So we need to adopt that, but what do we need to abandon? So if you're going to take on the Dharma, what are you willing to let go? It's like on a balloon. If you want to fly high, you need to throw something out of the basket. If you want to climb a high mountain, you must be willing to leave everything else behind. In times of bushfires, the first things that people protect is family, kids, husbands, wives, everybody, then the family photos, and then the pets. Everything else can go. Everything else can go. So it's the same thing here in the spiritual path. We take what we need for our spiritual growth. It's like Arya Shantideva says, you know, you become like a bee that goes from flower to flower. You only take what you need for your spiritual growth. That's all. You don't need anything else. You don't need $100 million. You don't need 5 cars. You don't need to get married 10 or 20 times because by the first 2 or 3 times you should have learned your lesson. There is no permanent happiness in samsara. There is no permanent happiness in any relationship other than the one that you have with your lama. And the relationship you have with your lama is a template to all relationships. Work relationships, personal relationships, you name it. Because your lama, as we will see a little later on down the road, determines and shows you what is right, what is wrong. He or she points out to you, this is how you behave, this is what you say, this is how you think, this is how you free yourself, this is how you free the people that you love, this is what you let go of, and you let go of it now. Not when you say so, but when I, as your teacher, can clearly see this is the time for you to let go. You let go now. Jitsun Milarepa, who I mentioned earlier on, who killed 38 people, he met his lama, his root guru, his primary teacher. And because he was a mass murderer, he needed to work off an incredible amount of negative karma. So his teacher gave him physical hard work to do for years and years and years. And Milarepa said, come on, when are you going to give me the good stuff? Where's the teachings? I'm here for the good. Where's the tantric teaching? I want the teachings. You know, and Mapa Lazar, who was his teacher, said, well, dude, you killed 38 people. You know, I mean, come on. You can't expect to go on a happy Dharma camp and you know, forget it. Let's forget, 38 people. Sorry about that. I didn't mean it, you know. No. Pick that rock up. Build me a tower. Okay, now pull it apart. Build it over there now. Okay, pull it apart. Build it on and on and on until he had his back was bleeding, infested with sores. Yeah? Only after such physical exertion, through all that, years of that kind of work, he managed to just a little bit purify, a little bit, enough of his negative karma just so he could receive the teachings. And then he became the real practice of purifying all those murders that he committed. That's how heavy it is. But that can only happen when you have a teacher that you have a strong karmic connection with. And as I was alluding to before, because we want the best, we all think, oh, His Holiness the Dalai Lama is my personal teacher because he's the creme de la creme. But we don't have the karma to be a disciple of the Dalai Lama. The person that we have a karmic connection with, he or she, may not even have called a lama, may not even have those kind of qualifications. But yet, they have the strongest karmic connection with us. So when they say something, yeah, that's it, that's right, I got it. I read that 50 times in that book and I did it. My teacher says it to me and it just makes sense. That's the blessings from a realized person. If you see someone and you regard them as a Buddha, if you regard them as a Bodhisattva, if you regard them as a normal person, nothing. Again, precious human rebirth. Only through this form can we actually learn that, retain that information, implement it, realize it, and progress along the path, and use that to really help the people that we love. If you care and really, really love the people in your life, whether they are alive or dead is irrelevant. They are still in samsara. Nobody's going anywhere. So there's still time to help. So somebody asked His Holiness the Dalai Lama in one of the public teachings what on the surface seemed like a very silly question. But again, as I said before, there are no silly questions in Buddhism. Your Holiness, if the Buddha achieved enlightenment for everybody, why do we have to achieve enlightenment for everybody as well? Well, His Holiness said, because even though the Buddha achieved enlightenment, he liberated many, many sentient beings in this world and other world systems as well. Still, what about us? We're still here. So you need to achieve enlightenment because you have more karmic connection with people in your family, at work and other places than the Buddha has with them. So therefore, now you as a Buddhist, they are your responsibility. Keeping in mind that the strongest karmic connections we have are with people who are our enemies, people with the strongest emotions. Now we like to all believe and live in a Hollywood fictitious world of make-believe, where we say that love is the most strongest force we have. Love will conquer everything. But in fact, anger is the strongest force that we possess. And anger is the cause that will send us to a lower state of existence. And anger is the first thing, when we pass away, when we die, anger is the first thing that ripens. That is the thing that will determine more, because it is so powerful, it overrides all other virtuous actions. It's like basically putting a match to a haystack that's miles high. One match, and all that virtue just goes. So anger is the first thing that ripens. So us as Buddhists, we must be afraid of that. We must be conscious of that. And therefore, we must work on those negative emotions first. But here we go. That's in general terms. It all depends on our psychological standing. Without understanding our psychological profile, a lot of people, for example, when I speak about death, I don't want to know about death because maybe they've been traumatized. Maybe they've seen too much death in their life. They come from a war zone or something like that. You can't speak about death to somebody like that. You need to talk about love and compassion. You need to talk about light things. So again, psychology here needs to be implemented. You yourself need to understand that about yourself, as I said before. For those people who live in a very luxurious way, you need to know about death more than anybody else. Oh yeah, I'm the best. No, you're not. Death. Death pulls the rug right under you. Pride. You know, if you're a bodybuilder or something like this, you know, looking yourself in the mirror, you need to think about death on a daily basis. Not about how handsome you are, but about how impermanent you are. Okay. We've got about 25 minutes, and I didn't even get halfway through what I was going to discuss. I haven't done this for about 4 years. Usually I used to have a weekly class at Kichok Rinpoche Center for about 9.5 years. So I haven't done this for 4.5 years, so I'm sorry if I'm a little bit shaky, a little bit if I went around in circles. But I would like to now end now with what I call the Chenrezig purification practice, which is an extrapolation from the Vajrasattva practice. But because we don't have a karmic connection with Buddha Vajrasattva, it's very difficult for people to visualize or understand. But a Buddha is a Buddha, you know? It makes no difference. At that level, whatever Buddha, they're all of the same nature. They're all the same nature. So therefore, we all in this world, in this world that we live in, we all have a karmic connection with Buddha Chenrezig, which is the Buddha of compassion. He's the 1,000 Buddhas of this eon, including the fourth Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, they are all an emanation of Buddha Chenrezig, the Buddha of compassion. That's why sometimes you'll see Shakyamuni Buddha with a lotus in his hand. That's a sign that he's Chenrezig, the Buddha of compassion, who His Holiness the Dalai Lama is an emanation of, who Dzongtsa Kensei, he's Manjushri, sorry. His Holiness the Karmapa is an emanation of Chenrezig. Atisha is an emanation of Chenrezig. Jitokapa is an emanation of Chenrezig. Basically, everyone in Tibet that you've heard of is an emanation of Buddha Chenrezig. That's why Buddha Chenrezig is the patron saint of Tibet. And we all, whether we believe it or not, we all have a karmic, strong karmic connection with Buddha Chenrezig. Buddha Chenrezig, Buddha of compassion, how can you say no? So therefore, it's easy to visualize, it's easy to appreciate. Kuan Yin is an emanation of Buddha Chenrezig. Different culture, different iconography, same thing. Same Buddha, really. Kuan Yin, feminine. Chenrezig, masculine. A Buddha doesn't have a gender. gender is only for biological purposes. It's not for spiritual purposes. You know, you don't need to be male or feminine. You do if you want to have babies, but not if you want to achieve enlightenment. Yeah. So therefore, if it's male or female, it makes no difference. Yeah. So Buddha Chirayasi, we visualize above our heads and sort of at a 45 degree angle. For those of you familiar with the thousand arm Chirayasi, good luck with that visualization. You can visualize that. For those of you who are familiar with the forearm Chirayasi, that's good, very good. For those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, which is okay too, visualize like a white light, like a white snowball. White, pure white, with a tinge of pink, just a shade of pink. And visualize that as the essence of Buddha Chirayasi. Yeah? Then you have to strongly believe that Buddha Chirayasi is in front of you. Because I haven't had time to talk too much about karma, I have to kind of skip the gun here a little bit. From Buddha Chirayasi's heart, when we begin to recite the mantra together 21 times initially, then after that silently for a short period, and then after that we come back 21 times out loud together, we visualize from Buddha Chirayasi's heart white light and nectar, which is like a liquid that comes to the crown of your head. And just like a vase, the nectar and white light goes inside your body, straight down to your toes, comes back up because it's a liquid, it comes back up and flushes everything out of your system. It comes, and like an overflowing vase, it overflows from the crown of your head and washes out all the negativities in body, speech and mind. And all those negativities come out from the crown of your head, from your tear ducts, from your mouth, like you're vomiting, from your ears, from under your fingernails, from under your toenails, from your lower parts of the body, like you have diarrhea, from all the pores of your skin, all this black ink, petroleum kind of like poison, if you like, comes out. And that is all the negative actions you've done in body, speech or mind. I haven't spoken about karma, didn't get around to it, don't have the time. But just doing this visualization alone is not enough. Obviously this is a crash course here. We need the four opponent powers. The Buddha said, scripturally, how do we know anything is valid? One, the Buddha said so. Two, we're dependent upon our sensory perceptions. And three, we can infer. So, scriptural citations tells us that we can purify any negative action. Adolf Hitler can purify his negative actions. It will take an incredible long time. But it is possible if we apply the four opponent powers. With the four opponent powers, this now becomes actual purification practice. If you don't have the four opponent powers, it just becomes a nice white light visualization, which really doesn't mean anything, to be honest. It becomes a therapeutic session. Wow, that felt so good. Well, you might as well have a shower. It's more practical, to be honest. Now, with the four opponent powers, you're actually cooking with gas. You're actually doing something. You're actually purifying. Four opponent powers are regret. Keeping in mind that you have Buddha Chirayasi in front of you, or the essence of Buddha Chirayasi as a light with a shade of pink, physically there. before the Buddha, Chenrezig, you strongly regret all the negative actions you have done in speech, mind and body. All the lying, killing insects, yeah? Everything, the promises unkept. And previous lifetimes as well, murder, abortion, encouraging other people to hurt other people, lying, pretending to be something that you are not, etc., etc. All these things can be purified. Strong, strong regret. Now, precious human rebirth. Now I have some understanding of what this means. Now I have some understanding of the repercussions if I don't do this. Now I have a karmic connection with Buddha Chenrezig. Much more than I understood before. It's not just a statue. It's a physical entity now before me. First, the pound of power. Strong regret. Second, reliance. Because of these strong actions, I take heartfelt refuge in you, Buddha Chenrezig. You are the only one that I have the strongest karmic connection with at this time to help me to purify this action. Please, please, please do not abandon me. Do not abandon me. Do not abandon me. Then you promise to the best of your ability not to do this again. The catch is here, to the best of your ability. Not to say, I promise never to do it again. Whoa, I don't think anybody can promise that. So to the best of my ability, I promise not to do this again. Then the antidote. The antidote is twofold. There is the general antidote and the specific antidote. The general antidote is, I promise not to do any of these karmic actions again. And the antidote to all suffering is practicing the Dharma. The specific antidote is, for example, if you've just had an argument with somebody and you just threw something at them and you hit them, and the specific antidote is, I strongly regret what I have done and I promise specifically not to do that again to that person, never to get into an argument like that with that person again and anybody else. That's specifically promising. Do you understand? Specific and general antidote. So with those four pound of powers, as we're reciting, it's a lot here, I know, first time around, but I have no choice, but I have to give it to you in this way. With these four pound of powers, you can purify murder, you can purify the heaviest karmic obscurations. This is your introduction to it. This is extrapolated from the Vajrasattva practice. Buddha Vajrasattva specifically vowed, specifically appeared in the world, that anybody that recites my name will be purified of all negativity. As I said, we don't have that karma, we have Buddha Chenrezig. Same thing. In addition to the visualization, I'm sorry, if the snowball, for example, is not simple enough, you can visualize His Holiness the Dalai Lama in front of you, if that's enough. Happy smiley face, you can't go wrong. So, 21 times, you're following my lead. So, as long as I'm verbally saying it, you're saying it with me. When I drop, you say it, whisper it to yourself, anybody beside, not too loud to disturb anybody beside you. We come back with 21 more, okay? Then when I say, Om Mani Padme Hum, then you visualize that just like Niagara Falls, it's a shower, it's all coming down. As we're saying Om Mani Padme, it's Niagara Falls, it's overwhelming, it's your shoulders are being pressed down. That's how heavy this white light and nectar is, right? When I say Om Mani Padme Hum, that last one, you visualize finally the last flush. It flushes everything out. And then stay with that, meditate with that, that you are now crystal clear. You are a crystal vase, inside and outside, flawless. Nothing remains. Nothing remains. You are free of all karmic obligations. You have purified all your negative action. So once you feel that, that's your placement meditation. You put your mind on that and you meditate on that, and then I'll wake you up. Okay. So, strongly believe it's happening. Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum,
Vamane Bebe Hum, Vamane Bebe Hum, Vamane Bebe Hum, Vamane Bebe Hum, Vamane Bebe Hum, Vamane Bebe Hum, Vamane Bebe Hum, Vamane Bebe Hum, Vamane Bebe Hum, Vamane Bebe Hum, Vamane Bebe Hum, Vamane Bebe Hum, Vamane Bebe Hum, Vamane Bebe Hum, Vamane Bebe Hum, Vamane Bebe Hum, Vamane Bebe Hum, Vamane Bebe Hum, Vamane Bebe Hum, Vamane Bebe Hum, Vamane Bebe Hum, Vamane Bebe Hum, Vamane Bebe Hum, Vamane Bebe Hum, Vamane Bebe Hum.
Now, that's it. Now the most important thing, like all spiritual practice, specifically the Buddha's path, we have to dedicate the merit. Because without dedication, as soon as you walk out that door, you find somebody scratch your car, you get angry. Everything virtuous here is just gone in smoke. It's that haystack that's just gone up in flames. Yeah? So we dedicate to all mother sentient beings. May they be as fortunate as we to have this opportunity to come in contact with the Buddha's teachings, develop unshakable faith in the Triple Gem, follow in the footsteps of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas of the three times and ten directions. And may they quickly be free from all suffering in body, speech or mind, human, non-human or otherwise. May we quickly and ourselves rejoice in that. May all the, for us who have teachers, may they have long lives, good health and happiness. May all their wishes be fulfilled. May all those sincere Dhamma practitioners, may they never be in want of money or resources or any opportunity to receive teachings, to go on retreats, to go on pilgrimages. May they find sponsors. May they themselves find work, whatever is necessary to find the money resources that they need to continue along the path to enlightenment for the benefit of all mother sentient beings. May the Dharma, in all its forms, in all its traditions, never diminish one bit. And may we in turn be upholders of the Buddha's teachings, flawlessly and effortlessly uphold the teachings. Sarva Mangala. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any questions? Please speak up.
I sense a conflict in when we seek detachment. It's not an attachment to our lama, an attachment we have to overcome as well.
It's a virtuous attachment. It's a virtuous attachment. If you're sick, you need a doctor. You need the best you can afford. In this case, affording means having the karma. Yeah? So it's not an attachment in the sense of I'm attached to Scarlett Johansson, for example. It's not that at all. It's a virtuous attachment. It's a productive, constructive attachment. The only time attachment becomes a negative problem when it comes to teacher-disciple relationship is when you regard the teacher, he or she, whoever they may be, as a father figure. And because, you know, you come from a broken home or something like that, you never grew up with a father, all of a sudden you're now seeing this person, treating them as a little bit more than a lama, you know what I mean? Sometimes, and there's that negative aspect to it, where you're searching, you're not really looking for spiritual guidance, you're really looking for a father figure or a mother figure, depending on the person, or both. That's a negative way, because then you're blind to the spiritual aspect. The other negative aspect is where you've come from perhaps a troubled home or something like this. Damn that home environment. you have problem with authority because you were beaten or something like this, mistreated. So you come to a class like this and all of a sudden, boom, I'm the authority figure. I hate you, Robert. I hate you. And basically you're saying you hate your father, you hate your mother, whatever it is. So that becomes a conflict. And that's impossible to teach the Dharma somebody like that. But when you coming without, when you understand psychologically where you're coming from and you understand you want teachings, then being attached to your teacher, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, it's a virtuous thing. You know, you protect them. You want to be around with them because you know you're going to be learning. And they make you feel good, you know. And the reason why you feel good around them is because, not so much because they're enlightened with yet, but because the byproduct of them practicing the Dharma is that everybody benefits. That's why, you know, animals, you know, sometimes when you walk with people, virtuous people, you see animals from nowhere just come along and say hello, you know, and all this stuff. We see that when we read the scriptures, you know. He's living in a cave and there's a tiger sleeping beside him, you know. And that's a byproduct of that yogi's practice, compassion. So the animals don't feel threatened, the animals feel good in that person's aura, if you like. Yeah. So the whole teacher-disciple relationship is very dangerous. That's why His Holiness never talks about it to Western students, because it's been abused. The word guru is very grating, because it's just been abused so much. We hear, oh, this guru, you know, he's got three wives or something. What? He's got $1 million stashed away. He's got a private Learjet or something. What? So it's been abused so much. And it's something that it's not really, it's only reserved for the really, really hardcore, serious people, like 10, 20 year students, really, that really want to do, without being ordained. I mean, if you're ordained, you've got no choice. You have to have a guru, you know, living in a monastic community. But if you're a hardcore lay practitioner, it's not discussed until you really prove yourself that you really want to do this, you know, and then, you know, the teacher finds you. It's actually the teacher finds you. You don't find the teacher finds you. That's actually true. It's what the Sufis say. It's really true. From my experience, from people that I've spoken to over the years, here and abroad, the story is basically always the same. The journey is always the same. Why? That's one of the things I wanted to speak about. Because we all possess, in Buddhism, we say we all have the same mind, but we have different karma. Anybody who studied philosophy at university or something like that, that's like, wow, man, you just blew my mind. We all have the same mind. What are you talking about? That's not... No. The analogy that I usually like to give is, it's like the internal combustion engine. Like motorbikes, Ferraris, trucks, you know, and all these different vehicles. They run on the same principle, the same physics, right? But they all have different purposes. They look different. They have different colors, you know? Tuk-tuks and Ferraris and Porsches and all these kind of things, you know? They all run the internal combustion engine. But because they have different utility, different purpose, they appear differently. So likewise, all of us here, we have the same mind, but because of our karma, we all have different gender, different culture, born in different countries, different families. But when I say the word jealousy, we all know what we're talking about. How is that possible if we're different? And if we are so different, how is it possible then to actually learn something that is beyond our experience? Because if only the Buddha can achieve enlightenment, if we have a separate mind, then only the Buddha can achieve enlightenment. Forget about the rest of us. But that's not what the Buddha said. The Buddha said we can all achieve enlightenment. Scripturally, even if the worms and maggots decide they want to achieve enlightenment, the Buddha said, yes, you can do it. Yes, we can. As Barack Obama says, yes, we can. You know? So that implies that our minds, the consciousness, it's all the same. It's just the karma. What we like, what we don't like, what we hate is different. And from that karmic action, different results. Somebody likes blue, somebody likes purple. From that, different things happen. That's why I've always been taught by my lamas, if you can help one person, you can help everybody. All the same. That's so this universality. That's where all this comes from. Once you begin to understand Buddha nature, you understand everybody. You understand even the dog's emotions, even non-humans, because it's a consciousness, sentient. They have a consciousness. Once you understand your suffering, you understand everybody else's suffering. Once you understand everyone else is suffering, you develop compassion. Then, from compassion, you develop loving kindness. What's the difference between compassion and loving kindness? Now I'm jumping the gun here. Okay, so it's a smorgasbord. All right. Difference between compassion and loving kindness. Compassion is seeing what you have. I see what you have, and I wish you didn't have that. You got a headache? I'm sorry you got that. Compassion. Loving kindness. I see what you don't have, and I wish you had enlightenment. I see that you're too much self-absorbed. I'm sorry you have that. Maybe free yourself a little bit from that. I wish you were a little bit more happy, a little bit more in tune with the Dharma. That's loving kindness. Then, universal responsibility, Mahayana path. I personally pledge to take personal responsibility for the enlightenment of every sentient being that has a karmic connection with me. Every sentient being for all time, every time. As Aryashantideva says, as long as space exists, may I stay to relieve the suffering of all mother sentient beings. Okay, that's for another time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert. Very much appreciate that good introduction, and we look forward to having Robert again here next week for part two. And certainly I have some questions, but I'll wait until next week to hear first in terms of the overview of the Tibetan practice to ask my questions. And certainly I would also invite anyone else who has questions about the Tibetan practice to also come back next week and ask those questions of Robert too. Is that okay?
Yep.
Have a Q&A session? Fantastic.
Yeah.
And of course, as everyone knows, this talk is actually part of a whole course of the Path to Enlightenment. And part of what we wish to do here is to have this open dialogue about the different traditions. And so if anyone has those questions, if they can ask that of you too next week.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Yeah. Wonderful. So thank you again, Robert.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for patience.
And look forward to seeing you all next week. Thank you.
Cheers.